I want to ask you about the emotional brain. You have a part of the book where you talk about the emotional brain, and it reminded me yet again how it's the older and more evolved part of our brains than the rational brain. But I think we kind of interact more with the rational brain. It's more accessible somehow. Mm. And the emotional brain is somewhere deeper in there.
I'm so glad you're asking this question. Keep going. I don't mean to interrupt. I just got very excited. Please continue.
The reason why I paused and thought about it, because in the world of investing, you know, we're told to be rational about it. And money is a very emotional game. I work with families who invest money over generations. I know what an emotional experience it is for them. Money has meaning in their life. But in the world of investing, there are moments where you have to keep your emotions in check and stay rational. Can you talk about that dance between the emotional brain and rational brain?
Oh my God. If you edit this program, put this at the beginning. You cannot keep your emotions in check. It is not a thing that people can do. And also,
I love
it is the worst strategy ever to say to yourself and other people, let's be rational here, not emotional. And third, people who make decisions devoid of emotional content or as much as they can make worse decisions than people who make decisions when they're being over emotional. These are three things that we have learned in the last 70 years of neuroscience that completely go against something that people think that I would probably say.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question. What it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, Search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. My guest today is David McCranny. He's a science journalist with a deep interest in brains, minds, and culture. He's the creator of the blog, book, and podcast, You're Not So Smart, which was initiated to understand self-delusion and motivated reasoning. His journey, however, started with diverse experiences, including construction work, selling leather coats, and owning two pet stores. In 2009, McCranny started his blog, which quickly became an international bestseller, translated into 17 languages, and later into a popular podcast. This podcast features interviews with scientists exploring the psychology of reasoning, decision-making, and judgment. McCranny has authored two more books, You're Now Less Dumb and How Minds Change. Additionally, he travels globally to give lectures on these subjects. His early career as a newspaper reporter saw him covering Hurricane Katrina, NASA's rocket testing, and more. Following How Minds Change, McCranny wrote, produced, and recorded a six-hour audio documentary delving into the history of the concept and the term genius. Today, we learn about David's childhood and early passion for journalism. We have a deep and broad discussion about our decision-making with the realization that we're not that smart. David has some strong comments about the dance between the emotional and the rational brain. We tie it back to investing, the field where we are supposed to be rational, and without emotions. But is it really the best advice? My guest shares some thoughts about changing our minds and how to go about it. Stay tuned until the end when we talk about the meaning of the word genius. As much as the word might feel familiar, I've been looking at it differently since my conversation with David. Please help me welcome David McCraney. Well, hi. Hello, David. So nice to see you. How are you?
Aside from all, you know, just regular life things that happen to a person that get in the way of doing the other things you're going to do, for the most part, just fine. I'm doing just fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I've been looking forward to this conversation. I read your books and I followed your podcast. And as I mentioned to you, you have a way of presenting some really life-changing ideas in a way that's very relatable. And I'm going to jump right in. And okay. I'm curious about the early days, your childhood, if you indulge me. I'm curious how you think that time influenced your career, your path, and this particular curiosity that you've been expressing through the books and the podcast.
Oh, yeah, definitely very influential. I grew up in the Deep South, the United States, southern Mississippi, about an hour north of New Orleans, the big city that you would go to if there was like a concert or some sort of big event. It would be usually in New Orleans. But most of the time, I was alone in the woods of South Mississippi. Grew up in a trailer in the woods, lower middle income, income family. And I was an only child. And because I'm an only child and I'm a latchkey kid, I was alone most of the time. And I would spend my summers with my grandparents' farm, which was really close by. And so I spent most of my childhood running around in the woods with dogs and building things out of sticks and just sort of meditating. I would later learn that I was engaging in things that were very similar to meditation, because I would have these very quiet, zone out, kind of have these mildly psychedelic alone time experiences. And my mom was a big reader. She read, but she only read romance novels for the most part. And my dad had a giant collection of old sci-fi books that he kept in a liquor cabinet. And I was consuming all of that stuff. So I was reading a lot of romance novels. My mom would take a big satchel of romance novels to the used bookstore and then switch them out for new ones. And I got really good at learning how you got to the good scenes in it and everything. But that was one half of things. The other half was reading these classic sci-fi, Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke and Asimov. And these both, those books all described a world that I wasn't living in. I was very fascinated by it. And I just started to reach out into the world to try to understand how do people work? I was getting very deconstructive from a young age. And that led me to, I'm just on that cusp of Gen X where you live before and then after the internet. So when the internet did arrive, I was like, yes, give me, I'll go everywhere. And I was a very early adopter to everything. And very early adopter, not just to early internet access to information, but early internet access to different cultures and the culture of the internet. So all of these things were very formative. And my dad is like a really strong Vietnam vet prepper. So he's like teaching me how to hunt and fish and construct shelters and survive in the wilderness and kill a variety of animals and skin them and store the meats. And so I have this eclectic mix of very analog life and very digital life. And it's all marbled with this desire to what are we doing? Who are we? What are we? And I was very lucky that my dad got a subscription to, because of these interests, he got a subscription to Discover Magazine. It was a great science magazine that had I looked forward to it every month. So all these things are super influential on my eventual desire to study psychology. And then when I was studying psychology, I switched over to journalism because this literary background and this psychology background needed to mush together somehow. And unbelievably, they have. So that's sort of the background of everything.
Now that's remarkable. I can relate. I spent a lot of time in the woods as a kid walking with my dog. And there were a lot of hours when I would be just by myself with my thoughts. And then I would grab a book, sit under a tree and read. And in some ways, my life hasn't changed much. You can still find me with a book. And there's always a new book that I have to read. And the list is endless.
We're seeing eye to eye here. Yes, that was a lot of my childhood. It was intense introspection, but with portals to other worlds. But no exactly. one to play with. No brothers or sisters or cousins or anything. So that alters the way you want to understand. It's like it's like having all these engineering documents for building like a clock or something. And then, but you have nothing to build with. And then one day the internet comes along, and then that comes along right as you're going into your teen years, and you're awash. It's like, and then so one day a truck comes mm-hmm. up and backs up and dumps every part for every clock you could ever want and all the tools. You're like, oh, okay, let's go. And it turns out it's not like it was on paper. It's you know, when you're actually doing it, it's different. And that all really informed my upbringing. I guess I should mention too, like my mom fought for me to be in a gifted program. My next book is mm-hmm. going to be about this sort of thing. I was a very small school, and they only had enough funding to have like 5 kids in their gifted program. And, mm-hmm. For like in 3 different age groups. And, my mom fought really hard for that, for me to get the IQ test and do all the things to get into the IQ program. And mm-hmm. that was very influential as well, because I was able to read the classics and read things way above my grade level, years mm-hmm. before I probably would ever been introduced, if I had ever been introduced to those things. So that was a big part of it too.
That's pretty remarkable. Tell me about the inspiration for the podcast and the book. So the big theme is that we're not so smart, followed mm-hmm. by some hope, and a challenge a bit that we can get less dumb. I like that thought, the other side of it. And then the last book that I was reading, with the idea that we can change our minds. So mm-hmm. 3 things, you know, getting smart, less dumb, and then changing our minds. Where did the inspiration come from? How did that come about?
Well, it came about because I was in, well, look, here's the full story. I'm in school to be a journalist. I'm in school to be a psychologist. And there's a sign on campus that I'm just walking by, and it says, this is a university. So I'm walking by and it says, opinionated, big question mark. And then underneath it, it was like, come to this place on campus. And I was like, yes, I am quite opinionated. I was that kind of, college freshman, sophomore. And I was like, I would love to tell you more about how opinionated I am. What's this about? So I go to the room, and it's the school newspaper. And they were like, yeah, we're looking for people who will write really good opinion pieces. And I said, oh God, that's awesome. I've always mm-hmm. wanted to try that out. And in one of my psychology courses, in one of the classes, we just learned about a study. And I don't know if this is replicated or if it ever was a substantial bit of research, but I remember that the professor told us that whenever someone who produces sperm, who is also a fan of sports, has a very favorite sports team, and that sports team loses, mm-hmm. that person's sperm count goes down. And our football team at our university had lost every single game that year of football. And I just thought of a mm-hmm. funny headline, and I made a headline for this opinion piece that said, sperm counts on campus reach record lows, according to scientists. And that's, the implication if the research is true. And then I wrote this opinion piece about how important it is to understand science and use that as the way in. And I thought that was funny. And one of my professors mm-hmm. in another class, not the psychology class, held that up and asked the class later on in the week, hey, have you seen this article? That is hilarious. And they didn't know it was me. And I was like, ooh, this is neat. There's something neat about this. And mm-hmm. I thought, maybe I'll try journalism out. And I took an internship that summer. And that summer I took this internship, and when I went to the newspaper, they did not have, one of the reporters had just quit. And they were like, would you like to just be a reporter for the summer? Like, we'll just pay you and everything. And I was like, I have no experience in this. Like, we'll teach you. So they gave me a desk and a computer and a notebook and a beat and a phone and said, go here, go do this. And so now I'm covering cops and courts and all these things. And I love it. It's really neat. You have this access to the world mm-hmm. you didn't have before. And then they were like, let's have it. Let's do a special section. And the special section was different eccentrics in town. And so I did that. And I did these profile pieces. And I was just like, this is everything I've ever, I love this. I didn't even know this was a thing that you could do or that I would love, but I do love it. And so I finished up my psychology courses, switched my major to journalism, became the editor of the newspaper, then left that, graduated, worked in newspapers, and then eventually made my way up into working for television news, where I was mostly behind the scenes, sometimes in front of camera. And that was when I stopped writing. And so this whole thing that got me into this, I'm no longer doing it. I thought, I would like mm-hmm. to start a blog. That's a thing that people are doing right now. So this gives you an idea where I was time-wise. This is around 2007, uh-huh. 8. And I thought, I have all the blogs at the time were single idea blogs, very thin sliced uh-huh. blogs, like mm-hmm. Shit My Dad Says was what was the name of one of them. Awkward Family Photos. These were just one tiny idea mm-hmm. blogs where you just hit that concept over and over again. So right. These were all things that were predicting how the algorithm would work, where you wouldn't just be a biology podcast. It'd be a podcast about the fingernails of, chimpanzees. This very thin slice, mm-hmm. very narrow.
Specialized.
And I thought, I have exactly what I want to do. There's nobody out here talking about this thing that I loved a lot in psychology that gave me a lot of, humility and helped me understand how to be a person and mm-hmm. helped guide me toward correcting things, critical thinking, intellectual humility, media literacy, these very important pillars, I think still to this day are the most important pillars for a modern person to have. Biases, fallacies, and heuristics. These three things, like most, like every time I'd ever told anybody about this, they would be like, but also, like, they're like, I wish you hadn't told me, but I'm glad you told me. Oh my God. Ooh. And you know, like things like confirmation bias weren't put really public knowledge at this time. They hadn't become popularized. So I started a blog and I thought a great name for, I'd seen Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. He would often, as a punchline, go, not so much. And I just thought, well, I'll make a blog titled You Are Not So Smart. And that was the name of the blog. You Are Not So Smart. I opened with the Invisible Gorilla Experiment and opened with Change Blindness and a bunch of other things that I thought were really cool. And the feedback was okay. But then I did an article about how people are brand loyal and why people prefer Apple over Android or vice versa. And that went crazy viral. And when that went super viral, I got sort of getting emails from book publishers that were like, hey, that thing that went viral,
write about it.
have you thought about making a book about this? Because I had a big backlog of stuff I'd already written. And I had this huge audience that went from like 1,500 readers to a million readers over the course of a week, thanks to a viral article. Wow. And I said, yes. And that's my life changed from there. And I've been just like, that's been 12 years ago. And over the years, I found my way into all these communities that I either I was a fan of or I was somewhat aware of, the skeptics community, rational humanism. I know almost all the major psychologists who work in this domain, neuroscientists, sociologists. Like, I've just become a member of that community, and we interact regularly, and I'm a member of different boards and stuff. It's just become my life and my beat, and I love it. So that's the shorter, I could tell about an hour long version of that, but that's the short for this podcast version.
I like that. You have this quote in your book, You're Not So Smart, that I really like. It says, you are naturally hindered into thinking in certain ways and not others. And the world around you is the product of dealing with these biases, not overcoming them. And yeah. I really like that on a personal level and in the world of investing where I spend most of my attention, I feel like it's a very powerful idea. Tell me more about that.
Sure. There are many things we could discuss in this domain. One would be just bounded rationality. There's also just concepts of the limits of cognition. I guess if I wanted to give you a big picture view of it, imagine trying to teach your cat differential calculus or something. Like, imagine taking a physics textbook and showing it to your cat, mm-hmm. and then what would happen next? That's an extreme example of your cat has some bounded cognition, some bounded rationality. Uh-huh. Like, your cat will never be able to agree or disagree with the terms and conditions of iTunes. This is outside the capacity of your kitty cat. And
right.
as advanced as we are as a species, and we're incredibly intelligent, especially in comparison to almost every other species on the planet, there are limits to what we can do with this brain. Mm-hmm. And I hate to break that to you, but it's true. And mm-hmm. those limits, we're not aware exactly where they lie, because we're really good at so many things. But that's the other thing. Like these limits also make it difficult for us to know what their limits are. So that's mm-hmm. one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is the within all the incredible things that this brain can do, this brain is a product of adaptation. It's the product of evolution over a very long time scale. And a lot mm-hmm. of the things we do innately or we do really well are things that were selected against to help us survive in previous conditions, mm-hmm. including previous social conditions, including previous ways that mm-hmm. we interacted with one another. And we are a social primate. So being a social primate means that we have a lot of the same tools at our disposal and predilections that guide us that other social primates, like bonobo and chimpanzees and even other social creatures like ants and bees, these as an emergent mm-hmm. phenomenon of intelligent systems and biological systems, these social dynamics are part of what we are. So all of that plays into us having certain ways of thinking we're more likely to fall back on by default if we're not really mm-hmm. effortlessly trying to overcome them. And those are called cognitive biases in the world of psychology and neuroscience and all the other social sciences. One most people think are familiar with is confirmation bias. That's whenever you are, it's often misdefined, I find, which is odd. Maybe that's ironic. It's when you encounter something novel or ambiguous mm-hmm. and you have a sort mm-hmm. of internal hunch as to what you're witnessing or experiencing, or you have a problem, then you have an internal hunch as to how to solve that problem. Or you have an outcome mm-hmm. and you're not quite sure what led to that outcome. You're not sure what the cause is to the effect that you're experiencing, but you have an intuition as to what it might be. And then when you go searching for mm-hmm. information, you go search for information to confirm the hunch. And when you find anything right. that seems to confirm the hunch, you just stop looking for any more information and go, I figured it out. That's your bias mm-hmm. toward confirmation. I think it's often labeled as, or described as, you search for information to confirm what you think, feel, and believe. That's part of it, but that's not the actual mechanism at play. That's just something that happens thanks to confirmation bias oftentimes. But the thing is, we don't actively disconfirm our assumptions. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. I was hanging out with, this is such a name drop, this is such a flex, but I was hanging out with SEAL Team 6, and we were talking about mm-hmm. this stuff. Long story how that happened. And they surprised me to tell me, they told me that when they go out on a mission, one of the last things they do is they go through a disconfirmation battery, a disconfirmation list, where every mission uh-huh. critical moment that could lead to a positive or a very poor outcome, they check mm-hmm. to see if they have disconfirmed whether they are correct about their assumptions in regards to that mission critical moment. It's an incredible strategy right. that should always be employed. And mm-hmm. as amazing as it's going to sound, science itself is at mm-hmm. its foundation an invention that we created to mm-hmm. get us to try to disconfirm our assumptions instead of confirm our assumptions. That's honestly like the root of all science. Like, mm-hmm. let's have a hypothesis about something, and then let's generate a null hypothesis, which would be, what if we're wrong? And let's just collect mm-hmm. evidence until we see mm-hmm. which has the higher pile of evidence behind it, and never stop doing that. And thanks to that, we disproved a lot of the things we thought were true over the millennia, and we're getting closer and closer to having a much more accurate understanding of how the world works. And thanks to that, we have the ability, you and I are talking to each other via this video streaming thing mm-hmm. because of that, because we started doing that a long time ago, and it's accumulated to this kind of stuff. you keep it on the confirmation side of things, and you end up living the life of a 1300s peasant forever. And you probably have met people in your life who are still kind of in that 1300s peasant way of seeing things. So that's what I mean by all that. And I also mean that the world we live in is a result of these things. All around you, you'll see the result of these cognitive biases playing out and the result of these cognitive biases being warded against. And there's a mix of both happening at all times. And there are other things in play here too. There's logical fallacies and mental heuristics. Very briefly, a logical fallacy is when you're attempting to solve a problem or have an argument with someone and you commit a error in logic that isn't really readily apparent to your conscious mind. It feels like you went right through from A to B, but you actually made a terrible regular mistake that people make. And then a heuristic is a shorthand. It's a way of thinking. It's a shortcut that we leap to. The availability heuristic is quite common. Like the whatever comes to mind the easiest in any situation is what you'll default to because it's because it's more available to you. You assume that it's more correct. It's just faster. So all of these things help us solve problems and navigate the world in a way that sacrifices accuracy for speed. And in the environment in which we evolve, that's a sound strategy. Like, we'll sort it out later. But right now, we need to make sure we eat, don't die, and make more of us. So speed versus act. I don't need to be right about stuff. I just need to solve this problem before bad things happen. So that's why we're this way. But we live in a much more complex and rich environment now. So all of this stuff, for me, every single aspect of this provides this beautiful humility that then connects me to everybody around me, because I know the president also is doing this. I know every billionaire is definitely doing this. Some of them very obviously so, because we're watching them do it every day on social media. And then I know that every well-meaning, well-intentioned person that I support is also doing this. My friends and family are doing this. And thanks to social media as well, I get to see my mom and dad and Meemaw are all doing this too. There's a real unity in this that that is derived from the humility. And that drives me in a lot of the work I do.
You touched on science, and there's a quote in your book, You're Not So Smart, that I also really liked. You said that in science, you move closer to the truth by seeking evidence to the contrary, which you touched on. And you suggest that perhaps that's the same method should inform our opinions as well. And I really like it. In the investment and research process, I always try to talk myself out of an idea first before I get excited about it, kind of flip it on its head. But
and you need to get other people to help.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, for sure. Get other people to help you in this. Here's some, because as much as you'd like to be the person that talks yourself out of it, we're really good at like out maneuvering. Like the mind contains multitudes. The brain has many, many different agencies working in concert. It's not just one unified. Like there's not one person in a control room like going, we're thinking this and we're doing this. You've got a cacophony of different inputs. Lots of different mental agents are at play. And there can be you can be in a situation. That's a great quote by Tennessee Williams. Sometimes a man wants to be stupid if it permits him to do something his cleverness forbids. That's true. That's true. Parts of you will outsmart other parts of you to get the things that they want. And you have you have to accept that about being a person. And it requires an immense humility. And we're all aware of people throughout media and celebrity and history who had incredible talents and contributed a great deal to our culture, yet their private lives were a real mess, and or they destroyed their lives through some sort of thing that they couldn't get out of, that was some private part of their life that they ruined the rest of their life, or you know, by historical standards, they were awful human beings, even though they may have contributed something that moved the culture forward. When it comes to what you're discussing, like, we have to assume that you have to have some system in play for recognizing you might be wrong. In fact, probably you are wrong. an introduction to this is, Will Storr gave this to me. This is how I introduce people to the concept of intellectual humility, which is what we're discussing. So anyone listening, here's a little exercise for you. Ask yourself, am I right about everything? And if there's, and we could do this broadly, like everything, or perhaps this is one issue that you're trying to work on. Like this one very specific problem you're trying to solve or the decision you're trying to make. So ask yourself, am I right about everything? And the answer here, if you're in any way honest with yourself, is, well, clearly not. I couldn't possibly be right about everything. But if you do think that, that's another conversation we should have. And perhaps you should, I always say as a joke, you should go into politics. That's where people who think they're right about everything go. But let's assume you I'll keep it broad to make this easy, is an easy exercise. Do you think everything, period, from every movie you've watched to every opinion you hold to everything every trivia fact you think you know the answer to, do you think you're right about everything? If the answer is no, then my follow-up question is, what are you wrong about? And if you can't answer that, because there's no way you can answer that question, how does that make you feel, right? Like, oh shit, I am wrong about stuff. I'm clear. I have a whole bunch of stuff in my mind that I'm wrong about. Now, let's wonder, like, this thing you're trying to do, this problem you're trying to solve, this decision you're trying to make, how many things that you're wrong about are affecting that? If this could be a voting decision, it could be an investment decision, it could be a major life choice. Do you have any system in play for sorting out whether or not you're right or wrong about things? Do you have any system in play? And if not, like, how important is it to you that you make good choices? So that's a real good introduction to intellectual humility. And there are many different ways to become a much more robust and better critical thinker from one situation to the next. But you have to start with this assumption that, oh yeah, I probably am wrong. And I would like to have some system for figuring out what ways in particular I may have things totally incorrect.
I like to say that I want to be the least wrong. I feel like a lot of people get into trouble, especially with money and investing, because they want to be right. They want to prove everybody wrong. But for a minute, if you assume that, what can I do to be the least wrong? And you mentioned all kinds of, you know, decision making. But for example, if I'm leaving the house, I forgot the umbrella and I'm going to get wet. I was wrong about the weather. Not a big deal. Small price to pay. I'll change my clothes. But if you put your money in a bank that goes bust and all of it is gone, there was a bigger decision that probably required a little bit more fact checking before you decided to put all your money with a questionable bank, right? So it's a different dimension. But so I will be wrong and some of the things won't matter. Yeah, okay, I'll get wet on a rainy day, but some things are really life-changing and maybe I should pay attention.
You got total agreement over here. And I strongly suspect that I'm not wrong about this, but I could be. It's right there for you. You can just use the simplest version of the Socratic method, the simplest version of the scientific method, and know that a lot of times the way through this is understanding what's motivating you to make a certain decision. And that's where we're usually the least honest or least capable of introspection. Like, if you did make a wrong choice, if you have noticed you did something and you were incorrect about it and it led to some weird outcome, take a moment and try to introspect, perhaps with the help of another person, what motivated me to commit to an incorrect decision? That's a very important thing to know about yourself. And it will open, because whatever motivated you there likely broadly motivates you across domains and is something that's worth understanding.
For me, it's a deep-rooted loss aversion.
That's an incredible amount of kind of self-knowledge, right? That can lead to all sorts of good and bad outcomes. But until you know you're doing that, that's an old Carl Jung quote. I think it was Jung that said this. He was like, and I'm paraphrasing, but until you know yourself and understand the motivations behind what you do, whenever you... whatever your life situation, where you arrive, good or bad, you'll call it fate. But it was motivated. Your choices led here. And those choices were driven by motivations. And those motivations may be something you've never introspected about.
I look at it as, the idea of eliminating, in terms of investing, I call them eliminating zeros, you know, having investments that can go all the way to zero. And I always assumed, I mean, for a while now, that if I can eliminate everything that can get me in trouble, the things that stay are the ones that can really help me on the upside. But I want to get rid of everything, or eliminate, or limit, minimize everything that can get me truly in trouble. And I am sure you can find stories in my childhood that would explain where it all began. But it's a big part of how I think about life in general, and especially investing. If I can get rid of anything that is a total loss. I had Luca Dallana on the show, who wrote a book about ergodicity. And I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he shares this idea that he gives an example of a skier, that it's not the fastest skier that wins, but the one that gets to participate in all the competitions of the season and win. So anybody that breaks a leg halfway might have been the fastest in the first five races, but it's not there. So there's a certain sense of, you know, survival, staying in the game until the end, not playing any game that's an equivalent of a Russian roulette where one of the bullets could be a total loss. That's something that really resonated with me. And in terms of being right or wrong,
there's a sound strategy. I like that.
Right? There's certain moments where...
And it's just knowing what you're going to... Like, knowing yourself well enough to know that have you created a sound strategy? Is it based on anything? And then now that you know that you're loss averse, you can go one step deeper with these questions, which is that a sound strategy? Is that something I need to like overcome, or is that serving me well? Uh-huh. And is it a mix? Is it nuanced? Is it in some situations that serves you well? In some situations it does not. Now I must create conditions so that I can, identify which situation I'm going into. One in which this will work for me or work against me. That type of self-knowledge is critical for making the decisions that lead to the outcomes that you want. You've got a desire, you get this outcome, and between that are billions of possible nuanced things about the human brain that you could reflect upon to get a better chance of reaching the outcome you're trying to pursue.
I think you can take any potentially good idea to its logical limits, and then it all gets distorted, right? Because when you hear loss aversion, it could also mean I'll never leave the house, right? It can take it to its absolute limits. So I think
it's really well put. It's good.
So any good idea, you know, but it's like with a cake, you like the cake, but you know, you don't want to have five of them. So you have to. There's the story of a guy that tries salt for the first time in his life. He's in this kitchen at a restaurant trying, and he never tried salt. And he loves it. So he asks the chef to show him what is it that he added, this white powder. And he shows him a big bucket of salt. And the guy tries to eat that salt with big, big spoons. And he says, it's horrible. It is horrible. But a little bit of it brings out something special in the taste of the dish. But if you want to eat it by the spoon, it's no longer a good idea. And I think with a lot of things we talk about, I think you have to take it with a pun intended grain of salt, a little bit, you know, that's moderation.
That's great. I like that a lot. That helps me understand that redefines that the bit of wisdom for me. I like that. When I say with a grain of salt, what I mean is, it's great. It's well done.
I want to ask you about the emotional brain. You have a part of the book where you talk about the emotional brain, and it reminded me yet again how it's the older and more evolved part of our brains than the rational brain. But I think we kind of interact more with the rational brain. It's more accessible somehow. And the emotional brain is somewhere deeper in there.
I'm so glad you're asking this question. Keep going. I don't mean to interrupt. I just got very excited. Please continue.
The reason why I paused and thought about it, because in the world of investing, you know, we're told to be rational about it. And money is a very emotional game. I work with families who invest money over generations. I know what an emotional experience it is for them. Money has meaning in their life. But in the world of investing, there are moments where you have to keep your emotions in check and stay rational. Can you talk about that dance between the emotional brain and rational brain?
Oh my God. If you edit this program, put this at the beginning. You cannot keep your emotions in check. It is not a thing that people can do. And also,
I love
it is the worst strategy ever to say to yourself and other people, Let's be rational here, not emotional. And third, people who make decisions devoid of emotional content, or as much as they can, make worse decisions than people who make decisions when they're being over emotional. These are three things that we have learned in the last 70 years of neuroscience that completely go against something that people think that I would probably say. And it is a thing that makes me bonkers, because this assumption amongst a lot of communities that I often speak to, whether it's tech, business, skeptical, rational humanism, even people who believe that they're really strongly scientifically oriented, it is, this is a completely, I have to be an iconoclast here. Look, and this is based off scientific evidence, the work of Antonio Damasio and many others. If you have human beings that have been, they've received damage to their brain through like a stroke or a injury or an illness that reduces their emotional capacities to the bare minimum. You can never completely extract it from human brain, but you can turn the volume way down on these parts of the brain that contribute to our decision-making and to our just humanness. You have to take a person like that and you say, okay, I want you to fill out this questionnaire. These are real studies they do. I want you to fill out a questionnaire. Please pick this blue pen or this red pen to fill out the questionnaire. This will be a 30-minute decision. This person will contemplate that a decision tree will appear in their mind and it will go to every possible outcome if they choose this or the other. Then they'll start wondering, why did that person ask me that? What could be the possible reasoning behind why they would want me to do one or the other? Is they up to something? How will this lead to my life 5 years from now, 10 years from now? How much have I ever, do you think this will make this readable? Like the number of things that you can put out there as to what could contribute more to the one pin color or the other is enormous. And, and a person will get lost in this and they will not commit to one or the other. And it'll take a minute. And then if you ask this person for an even more complex decision, like please pick a cereal from the cereal aisle, that's going to likely be impossible. They'll burn out before they can get, they'll starve before they get the cereal. All decision-making, all judgment, all planning and goal pursuit is informed by what we would consider emotional parts of cognition. It is a extremely almost like dark ages way of looking at things to think of the brain as being, or like a old Greek concept, to think of our consciousness and our thinking to be divided between logic slash reason slash rationality and emotion and passion. As far as the brain works, all this is working in concert, and emotional cognition is cognition. And it's probably better to frame it more like you have all of these advisors who are talking to the executive centers of your brain, offering incredible advice. Like they're like, some of them have had an enormous amount of experience in these places. Some of them are very good at these things. Some of them are very hesitant because they're thinking about certain outcomes where others are exuberant, and vice versa. And you can imagine the executive portions of your brain, like one of your advisors is like a five-star general who's, who's been in battle for like 68 different major engagements. They're giving you advice. And another advisor is a world-class chef who has served dignitaries around the world. And another advisor comes up is a poet. And another advisor is someone who once built a functioning biplane from scratch, just after looking at a couple of photographs. All these advisors are, are coming to you with a their input on how you're going to make the next decision. To make a decision devoid of emotion is making a decision with none of those advisors whatsoever, just pure math logic. And you're going to make the kind of decisions that a pure math logic being would make. And they are not going to be good for you or anyone else. In fact, most of the people who have had this kind of damage to the brain, they end up becoming hoarders because it turns out it takes a lot of emotion, emotional cognition to decide what should or should not be around you. And you default to this loss aversion thing. And most of them absolutely torpedo their life because they get focused on one thing and then they lose it because they get focused on this thing. And they make very poor life outcomes because the life decisions, because they are incapable of making, of taking other people's like well-being into play, their long-term well-being. They're like, I could go on. There's like dozens and dozens mm-hmm. of things that there are dozens and dozens, dozens of things that contribute to us making good or decisions or poor decisions. And the logic rationality side of things is just a sliver of the things that all contribute to it. You mm-hmm. can't make a decision based off logic and rationality without and say, I'm not being emotional right now. And there's no such thing. And a person who mm-hmm. does have that capability because of damage to the brain makes very bad decisions. And the very big like overall takeaway from this is a person who's like really driven by lust or driven mm-hmm. by prejudice or driven by anxiety or driven by reputation management and these sorts of things, these emotional qualities that contribute to poor decision-making, a person who is driven mm-hmm. by those sorts of biases will make poor decisions. But a person who is driven by no bias whatsoever will make even worse decisions. Mm-hmm. So
that's such a powerful statement you just said.
And look, when you decide to buy a car, that's an emotional choice. All the mm-hmm. advisors in your brain have contributed and mm-hmm. you've reached a tie-breaking moment and you go, I'm going to buy it. You take that away and a person just sits there waiting to go, I don't know, maybe this, maybe that, maybe that. So yeah, I'm very passionate about this because I come up against it a lot. Mm-hmm. I am a huge fan of reason and rationality and critical thinking and logic mm-hmm. and propositional constructions and Plato mm-hmm. and Aristotle and Socrates I am a huge fan of mm-hmm. critical thinking, rationality, intellectual humility. It's all I mm-hmm. ever talk about. But this is not the suggestion that these things are devoid of emotional content. Mm-hmm. As a human being, emotion is cognition. And it's a balance between receiving all of these bits and pieces of advice and having an executive control center that can go, let me take a look through here and see what would be the best choice based on this advice, not in like defiance of it. And that's huge. I could talk about that endlessly.
No, I love the sound of that. I'm a numbers guy, but I grew to appreciate the importance of emotions and feelings. And there's many ways to go about it. I say, for example, the quality of sleep. If you're holding a stock and you can't sleep holding it, it's a sign. You know, your body is responding to it. You just feel very uncomfortable holding it. I had a deep conversation with a good friend who became a mentor over the years, and he's a very rational person. And at the end of the conversation, we're talking about a bigger decision I was about to make at the time. And he said, Bogumil, at the end of the day, see how it feels. And it made me pause because I would never think of him even using the word feel. And he was very adamant about it. He said, just ask yourself, how does it feel? Mm-hmm. And I'm still thinking about that question. I ask myself that question in many other situations where after all the study, all the research, all the numbers, everything that I think my rational part of the brain, which you say is not really separate, processed. And I still want to know, does this feel right? And I've been in meetings with managements that show me beautiful numbers and beautiful annual reports. And I walked away feeling that I would not leave my wallet with these people. I don't know why. And it saved me from quite a few situations, just the feeling on a human level that something doesn't feel right. And a few years later, things come up, you know, fraud and accounting restatements. But in the moment, all I could rely on was not a fact, but a feeling.
Yeah, without these parts of our, and yes, some of them are very old, but like evolutionarily speaking, but all of it is. And without that, you really just become an algorithm. You just become a roll of the dice that mm-hmm. can talk. And that feeling you had, like it would be a bad move to just have the feeling and then make the decision, unless you're under duress, you need to do something like that. But if you have a chance to contemplate, I have a reason to go contemplate. Let me contemplate this. Mm-hmm. This hesitation that I'm experiencing is an emotional state. This, mm-hmm. the very desire to invest at all, instead of mm-hmm. just becoming a professional juggler, is an emotional mm-hmm. decision. Like the very desire to create this podcast and have this conversation is an emotional decision. why would you want to shore up your bank accounts to be able to survive possible crashes and troughs in the economy? Why do you want to do that? Anything that's an emotional reaction. Want, motivation, drive. These are parts of our emotional selves. The strategies by which we achieve outcomes will be informed by our rationality and very much mitigated by it and titrated by it. So you have to have both. I used to be very strongly in the camp of become Spock, become data, become pure logic beings. But if you do that, I mean, you might as well just be a stapler or a calculator. You're going to live the life. You're going to live the life of something like that. And you'll see this. I see this playing out in a lot of people who run companies. They have this installed as a philosophical concept that reason and rationality. Let's try to hold back our emotions in these decisions, and you end up with the sort of infrastructure in companies that are devoid of the passion and emotion. Look, I don't want to support anybody that wants to take us to the stars if they don't imagine that we would write poetry about what we see there, or they don't have it in their heart that they would like to experience it in that way. If it's a pure desire to just maximize outcomes so that we out-compete every other culture on the planet and then out-compete every other planet we might meet, I mean, that's villainous. That sounds like every sci-fi bad guy. That's the Borg. Like, I don't. So yes, I am passionate about including passion in your decision-making. Never be beholden to it, but never remove it completely from the decision process. Find your balance, make your rational, logical decisions using your emotional states as incredible advisors for those things, and compare and contrast. Any good decision you make should have a little bit of both. Like, I hope you experience this as well, where like almost every major life decision, you're going to have that like moment. Cause like a little bit of me wants to do this. A little bit of me wants to do that. That is a great moment to push away from the table of life and notice that. Notice these complex aspects of yourself and then serve. So there you go. You can see I'm very into this right now.
I love that. David, I want to ask you about patterns and looking for meaning. And you have this beautiful quote that got me really thinking. You talk about lucky streaks at the casino, hot hands in basketball, and a tornado sparing a church. You say these are all examples of humans finding meaning after the fact, after the odds are tallied and the numbers have moved on. I mean, these are all beautiful headlines for article.
Oh, yeah. I love this. Your listeners may be familiar with survivorship bias. I helped popularize this term way back. I seeded all our social networks with that picture of the airplane. I went and got all the original research on that. And because I had heard somebody talk about it once, and I was like, that doesn't sound true to me. It sounds like something somebody tells you at a business lecture, but I bet the truth is way more complex. And it was more complex, but the overall lesson is still there. So we could talk about it in two different ways. There's the Texas sharpshooter fallacy in survivorship bias, and they're similar in what they teach us. The Texas sharpshooter fallacy, you imagine a person is shooting at a barn over and over again, and they fill it with holes. Then they walk up to the holes and look for where they've clustered randomly, and they paint a bullseye that makes it look like they're a crack shot by putting the center of the bullseye where the densest cluster is. So after the fact, they draw the bullseye, which suggests that cluster had meaning or was intentional. This is something human beings do, where randomness is clumpy. Randomness is going to bunch up in places. And any sort of analysis, even big data analysis, is going to give you these clusters. And we will post hoc try to rationalize, justify, and explain why those clusters exist. And if we have a particular intention in mind or a goal in mind, we'll use that to create what kind of bullseye we're going to draw. This can be very dangerous in like medical outcomes. There'll be clusters of cancer or clusters of other illnesses in certain places. We'll try to understand why they're clustering up, and we'll look for what's similar between them. And sometimes it'll be something that would be it's in every community in the world, and we'll assume that that must be what it is. And it has led to weird things. It has led to weird assumptions about what's behind it, when what was behind it was probably, in some situations, it was just randomness being clumpy, and the true cause of the illness was something that was more surreptitious, more difficult to find than something that is obvious in the environment. And then, or it was just something that was true of just human beings in general over a long enough time scale. This is also true for what you're talking, for your areas of expertise and what you do. Like you deal with lots of data and it clumps up all the time. Mm-hmm. And
it does.
And we make sense of the world through narratives. We make sense of the world through beginning, middle, and end stories, justifications, rationalizations. It's how we create meaning as a human being and communicate it to others. Mm-hmm. And when you apply it to these clumps, it can become very dangerous because it may have just clumped up because things clump up. So that's something, one thing you have to know. The other thing is the survivorship bias, which is after any process that culls a population, culls bits and pieces, anything that deletes or destroys or removes from view stuff, the stuff that is left behind by this process will seem to be have some sort of unique quality to it because it will become a representative of the whole in a way that it isn't a representative of the whole. And the famous example is airplanes coming back from World War II. They're trying to make them more survivable. So they are like, where do we put the armor on them? They look at them. They see where all the holes are. They're like, that's where we should put the armor. But statisticians were like, no, dude, there's a bunch of airplanes that didn't make it back. And wherever they got shot is not where these planes got shot. So you put the armor where there's no holes. That's survivorship bias in a nutshell, is the winners of this world, the survivors of this world. And this includes people who are currently like very successful, people who are billionaires, people who are look like whiz kids, people who are guiding, like many of them are the survivors of some process that we aren't privy to. And the people who got obliterated by that process have clues about how to become a survivor that have been removed from view. And the qualities that these people have, like they skew your understanding of things. My favorite example of this is frontier log cabins. Frontier log cabins, or old cars or stuff like that. People will say, oh, wow, they don't build them like they used to. And the truth is, almost 99% of every log cabin is gone because even when they built them like they used to, they don't survive the weather. They don't survive that. They just get old. They, these few that you're looking at that survived it are lucky. They were in a lucky location and they were built with materials that no other cabin really can be built with. They're lucky survivors of a situation. And no, they don't build like these two. These cabins you're looking at do not represent the concept of a log cabin. And that's the same thing is going to be true for somebody who could possibly be a very successful investor, a very successful business person, and so on. They may be there because of luck. And if that's the case, the actual things you could learn from them are going to be lost because you're assuming they represent a category that they're not really a good representative of. So that's what all that comes down to.
I love the sound of that. David, I have one big last question for you about success. I like to ask my guests about their definition of success. How do you think about success? You had all those books, podcasts, and quite a bit of fame as well on around some big, big topics. I'm curious how you think about success.
It's strange. You're catching me at a I thought I'd already gone through this and found my level, but with how minds change, things are blowing up for me in a new way right now. I've just been on a massive year-long lecture tour. Next week, I'm going to be speaking at NASA. I've become a member of several organizations. The School of Thought, we just put out the conspiracytest.org. I invite everybody to go try it out. It's a place you can learn how susceptible you are to conspiracy theories, and you can share it with other people to help them see the same thing. I've joined the Alliance for Decision Education, the Society Library. Just it's a whole new stage of my life. I'm experiencing some interesting success right now. So this question, it's a good question to ponder. If I was going to give you the simplest, most sort of poetic answer to it. I think success is when you know you've reached a level of success when that I would consider true success. Uh-huh. When the balance has shifted to, I get up and do things that I want to do more than I do things that I have to do. I am able to today to pursue the things that provide meaning in my life. And there's going to be plenty of have to do's in that, but the balance mm-hmm. has tilted. I am able to make a living being me. That's mm-hmm. a huge measure of success. And I think that the way that shakes out is your life has tilted to, I get to do, I don't have to do. That's the balance that's shifted. And mm-hmm. the closer you can get, the better. And give me a huge caveat here. You're never going to be able mm-hmm. to have all of it. Like, it's never going to be all get to do. Just mm-hmm. getting it tilted a little bit where you're like, it's 20% of your day enough. Is more get to do than have to do. You have reached uh-huh. success, my friend, and try to maintain it as long as you can. And try to pass it to others. Like, do as much as you can to spread that around.
I love it. I don't know if you can share, but what's the next big thing that you're that's on your mind that gets you excited? That
yeah, I can't. I'm doing also a thousand things. Uh-huh. The I've got a lot of little projects kicking off that will become big projects. But the biggest one right now is I'm working on a new book about what does the word genius mean, which it also like is what is the word what does any word mean? So it's something I've wanted to talk about for a long time. How we articulate the ineffable. What do we, this idea of great figures through history. And it has a very simple premise. Like, what does the word genius mean really? Mm-hmm. And how come no one can answer this question? And that's what mm-hmm. I've discovered is the more experts I speak with, the more actual geniuses, quote unquote, that I spend time with, prodigies people with the highest IQ. I've spent time with the people that have the highest IQs in the world. The more difficult it becomes to define this term, to the point that it's becoming pretty apparent. It doesn't mm-hmm. actually mean anything at all. It's just a way of expressing an emotional state that we have in the presence of a certain kind of thing. And there's so much to explore in that. And I cannot wait to show it to everybody. I'm about 70% through with this. And I've been all over the planet interviewing people and witnessing things and going places to write a book that is about what does the word genius actually mean. So that's my next big project.
I love the sound of that. I think to me it's an expression of admiration of somebody's work, whichever field they're in. But I think there's a lot more to it, and I'm curious.
You're very well put. Like I would love it if there was we had these demigods. I wish we had Newton, Einstein. Mm-hmm. In music and art as well, from Da Vinci to Freddie Mercury. Like I want the genius to exist, but the closer I get, the more mm-hmm. I understand it, the more I'm like, that might be a very bad thing actually. And this is also arcs me from you are not so smart to no wait, you are pretty smart. And so what does that mean? Like when we find people like that, mm-hmm. what does it suggest about the whole panoply of human experience? So that's where I'm at. That's where I'm at right now. That's the big project I'm working on.
I think the challenge is that you might come across people that figured out one little aspect of life, and they may not necessarily be so successful with the rest of it. I'm curious if that's going to be part of the book as well, where you have somebody.
Well, I can tell you, I've met dozens of these types of people. I've spent time with people that have. I've spent time with a child with musical prodigies and super talents, and I've spent time with people that have IQs that are like max, like the mm-hmm. the highest. I've spent time with the man with the highest IQ in the world. Those types of people, mm-hmm. and that is pretty much how it works. Like. One great takeaway just for as a preview is IQ is a measure of something, but it's mm-hmm. it originally was just a way to sort people in a different which grade should you be in? Like, should you be in a higher grade or lower grade than your age in school? Mm-hmm. That's what it was created for. It was never meant to be anything other than that. So once you're out of school, what are we even talking about? And but it's got this new, it has a cultural significance and it does measure something. And further down the line, we have G, which is just the major measure of general human intelligence, which clearly some people will score higher or lower on any measure of this thing that we're describing as intelligence. But mm-hmm. what these measures typically measure, and I, this is my big takeaway, is it's, if you ever had a friend who was really into, maybe it might be you, it might or the listener, but it could be the listener or our listener's friend, but you're probably, there's somebody in your life who loves adult board games, like uh-huh. whether it's Catan or Dungeons and Dragons or something in that place where it's a game that you play on a table, tabletop gaming, as they would say. You probably have right. a friend who's really into it. And the thing that they enjoy most is, I've discovered in that world, is telling you how it works, explaining the rules of it to you before you play your first game. It's a real thrill for a lot of people. The faster, this is what IQ measures, straight up. The faster you get to, yeah, I get it. Let's start playing the game. That mm-hmm. is what IQ measures. How quickly you can discern from some instructions and some pattern recognition and all sorts of other things, the sort of rules of a bounded system and then work within it, how quickly you can do that is correlates very strongly with your overall IQ. That does not make you the person who's going to cure cancer. That does not make you the person who should be the leader of the free world. Mm-hmm. That's a skill set that can be applied to all sorts of other things. And the human being that possesses that skill set might have a lot of other things that make that skill set kind of and like it either won't be used or it will be used poorly or used for weird things. Mm-hmm. But it's just a skill set. It's like being able to jump very high or being able to run for long periods of time. It's just one aspect of a person that gets applied to all sorts of other things. And that's huge. That's huge because we have a lot of examples. I've met some examples of people who have incredibly high IQs, but that they didn't go into nuclear physics effort with that IQ. And even mm-hmm. if they had, you know, that's a one application that could be at a detriment to another application that would have maybe been more provided more mm-hmm. Given them what we were calling success more likely in their lives, or made it taken some poison out of the world that is going to still be there after they die that they could have applied their efforts to. So I love this topic, and I'm eager to show it to people.
I know you have to run, but it immediately made me think of the book Grit, the idea that you have to keep on showing up, right? So just because you scored really high on this score or the test or the other, are you actually going to show up? So you might have somebody, as you said, that figure out the game in a moment, and I need 5 minutes for somebody to explain the game to me. But it depends who's going to actually stay in that game to accomplish whatever it is, right?
That's really well put.
I
love the way you put that. That's really well put.
I mean, if it's research, you're going to spend 50 years researching something. And I think it's more about, you know, grit. People say grit, but it's true passion for it that you're going to show up. And that passion will outsmart, outwork everybody else. I think that's been my observation in life, that I think there were kids that were much smarter than me, but I kept showing up. And here I am talking to you today.
That's so well put. If you want to keep doing that game metaphor, okay, there's a person that's going to figure it, go, yeah, I get it. Let's start playing. And then 5 minutes in, they're like, I don't want to play this with you anymore. There's that, like you're describing. Or there's a person like, mm-hmm. while playing, they're super asshole. You know, they're like, nobody wants to play with them anymore. Or as they're playing, they're ridiculously competitive and they don't care what happens. I want to win. Or, you know, they smell really bad because they don't.
It doesn't help.
They don't have very good hygiene. Or they're a mega racist and love talking about it. Like mm-hmm. All these things are things this ability to learn the rules of a game very quickly is just one little bitty part of being a person. And I like the way you put it. Grit in the end of the day is going to be more useful to you.
Keep showing up. David, this was incredible. Thank you so much for your time. You've been so generous and I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you again.
These are, as we were noting earlier, like if I finally have reached a point in my life where I can just talk about what I'm obsessed with, and and for better or worse, if you ask me questions, I'll talk about it endlessly. So thank you very much for inviting me.
No, it all shines through your passion for it. And I'm looking forward to the next book, and I'll include everything in the notes so people can follow your work and discover. Thank you so much for today.
It's been a pleasure.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Sicard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Sicard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.